Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC in Governor Murphy's State of the State address on Tuesday, he promised to take on the kind of hate most currently on people's minds in New York and New Jersey.
I will proudly sign legislation to provide additional security aid for our houses of worship and to expand the definition of and penalties for domestic terrorism. And I thank both sides of the aisle for the support, and in particular, I thank my friend Assemblyman Gary Scherer for championing this cause. Gary, thank you.
Murphy also looked inward to take on another kind of hate.
To my fellow men, we can and must do better, not just by changing our own behavior, but by making the conscious choice to not ignore the behavior of others. And to the women listening, we will listen and we will act.
And he took on a third kind of hate, too.
In this 401st year since the first enslaved Africans arrived on the shores of this continent, we're committed to furthering the work of the Amistad Commission and the NJEA Amistad Stakeholder Group to ensure that the African-American story is made real, not just for all of our students, but for our educators as well, through the new Amistad Journey program.
The governor also made a promise, we'll see if he can keep it, to tackle at the state level the number one issue for many Americans nationally.
I'm directing the Department of Banking and Insurance to work with this new office to track the actual costs residents pay for the health care services that they receive. And then armed with this data, we will make smart decisions to limit cost increases and set new standards for quality and transparency.
And Governor Murphy promised to challenge an even bigger national condition, something so fundamentally American these days, he doesn't even have a plan for it yet.
So on that basis, I am creating a new task force. Government officials, academic researchers, and faith and community leaders with the specific charge to address wealth disparity from all angles and all causes. Their work will better inform our work in closing these gaps and ensure that the communities which have historically been left behind can help us lead.
No overarching plan as yet for our national inequality disgrace, but at least this for the Garden State, and it will sound familiar.
I'm going to fight every day for the middle class values that built New Jersey in the first place. It's why I am not giving up the fight for a millionaire's tax so we can ease the property tax burden. And a millionaire's tax will allow us to ease the property tax burden literally on millions of middle-class families and seniors, and it will do more to help fund our public schools. Overwhelming majorities of residents of all political stripes support this. We should too. The millionaires and corporate CEOs made out just fine in the last recession, and I assure you, they will again when the next one hits. Thanks to the federal tax system, the richest 400 Americans now pay a lower tax rate than the nation's middle class. That is the first time that has ever happened.
Governor Phil Murphy from the State of the State address on Tuesday. We will hear more clips as we go, as we welcome now Matt Friedman from Politico. He writes the daily newsletter called New Jersey Playbook. Thanks for doing this, Matt. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Big applause for the millionaire's tax there.
Yeah, but, you know, the people who actually need to pass it, the few people who really control the direction. They were, I don't know if they clapped. I doubt it because they're not passing it. The governor is not getting anywhere near his millionaire's tax.
Really?
He's tried since he came into office, despite the legislature having passed it many times under former Governor Christie, I think at least five times, knowing that the Republican governor would veto it. Once Murphy took office, everything changed.
In the clip, we heard his three-part rationale, I would call it, for that kind of millionaire's tax. So in this context, tell me who's against it and why. His rationale was New Jerseyans want to contain property taxes, which are used to fund the public schools, but they don't want to cut their education budgets. So another way is to tax the wealthy more in this age of gross inequality and have the state do more to fund the schools. There's certainly a logic to it. So why is it that controversial?
Well, what happened is after the legislature, which has been in Democratic control for close to 20 years now, they passed after passing the millionaire's tax several times, Senate President Sweeney, as soon as Murphy was elected, he said, well, the first thing I'm going to do is pass the millionaire's tax. But then the Trump tax cuts went into effect. The Trump tax plan went into effect. The SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction, was limited to $10,000. New Jersey has very high property taxes, highest in the nation. And so that adversely affected, or at least so the logic goes by the Senate president, the wealthiest New Jerseyans, because they're going to be paying more in property taxes. And he didn't want to hit them with sort of a double whammy on taxes by also increasing the income tax on income over $1 million, which is an important distinction. It's not just everybody who makes more than $1 million hits a higher tax rate. It's the tax rate applies to every dollar over $1 million.
Only to the dollars above $1 million in a given year.
Correct. But the Senate president's rationale, his stated rationale, was that this was just too much of a hit for these people and it could chase them out of state. And then New Jersey loses more tax revenue than ever. I think there's also, there's some amount of skepticism about that rationale, considering that they tried this again and again and again, granted before the SALT deduction was capped. There's a lot of political fighting over countless issues between the Senate president and the governor, despite their shared party. And this is often viewed through that prism.
Listeners, New Jersey listeners in particular, after 2 years with Governor Phil Murphy in office, how's he doing, according to you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How's Governor Murphy doing for your city or town, your industry, or anything else? Or react to anything from the State of the State address? We played six clips so far with more to come. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, with Matt Friedman from Politico, New Jersey. You wrote in the playbook that Murphy used much of the speech to contrast his administration's ideas with those of his predecessor, obviously Republican Governor Chris Christie. We heard some examples of that in those clips. And the speech was so progressive, I guess, that I see the veteran Star Ledger columnist Tom Moran, who I think we could say is not exactly Sean Hannity in his politics, wrote a column today called Comrade Murphy Steers Hard Left, Giving GOP an Opening. So I know you saw that because you flagged it in the playbook. What struck Tom Moran as so hard left that it might give rise to a new class of swing voters?
I think in his column he didn't specify a single thing as the most overarching, but I think the fact that there was no sort of appeal to property tax, middle class property taxpayers, or at least not a big appeal to that. And, property taxes again and again are the number one issue in New Jersey, and there was no unified big plan.
Except that the millionaire's tax, as we just discussed, is that, isn't it?
Right. Well, there's some, we can talk about where that money would go and be directed, but of course money is fungible. So if you have more money in the budget, you do have more money for potential tax relief.
But you're saying it's fungible. So even though Governor Murphy said so in the clip we played, it's not necessarily going to go to hold down property taxes and fund the local schools.
I've got to review my budget notes. There are certain funds that certain things are dedicated for. But like I said, everything is fungible. If you got more money in one fund, you've got more money that's freed up in other places. But I think it was the lack of a unified, cohesive message, really targeting suburban middle-class people who are concerned about taxes. Because certainly, you know, a number of taxes have been raised in New Jersey. There's been a lot of attention to progressive issues. His argument is that Murphy is really not paying attention to the sort of the suburbanites that we often think about when we think about New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, also when we talk about Moran, I think, you know, the columnist, his politics are generally liberal. But you also have to take into account that he's very pro-charter school, very anti-teachers union generally in his columns. And Murphy is very much aligned with the teachers union. So Moran's columns have never been particularly positive about Phil Murphy.
David and Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Good morning. I've called your show before. I'll find my calls annoying. I'll get off. No, I'm just great show on your topic. I'm fed up or complaining or frustrated about New Jersey Transit. Today is Thursday. For the fourth day in a row, my 7 a.m. bus showed up at 7:40. I work at a school. I get in at 8:30. The principal doesn't want to hear me being late. And I just thought, I'll get off the phone. Great show. I just think the governor is afraid of New Jersey Transit. And that's all I got. Great show.
David, thank you very much. Well, he did mention New Jersey Transit in the speech. I didn't pull that clip. He didn't seem to get very specific about how he's going to fix it.
No, he didn't. And one of the big controversies is over New Jersey Transit's funding sources. And, you know, the legislature has been calling for more dedicated revenue to New Jersey Transit, for more increases, both administrations. And there's a story in the Record detailing this. It's been detailed before. Both administrations have diverted funds from other sources to fund New Jersey Transit. And the agency under both Phil Murphy's administration and Chris Christie has dipped in extensively to its, you know, capital funds, which are meant for long-term projects and everything, to pay for immediate needs. New Jersey Transit really did see its decline under Christie. The problem is that, you know, under Murphy, it really has been slow to pick up. A lot of people feel that it's where they left it. New Jersey has a huge number of commuters, obviously, right next to New York City. It's a big issue, and it's not an easy boat to turn around.
Joe in Rockaway, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Thank you for the opportunity. One thing I'd say as far as Governor Murphy goes is he's doing a good job because he hasn't hurt us. And in today's political climate, I think that's a wonderful thing.
The blessing of low expectations. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Like the doorman on that show back in the 70s. Anyway, the thing that concerns me is when I hear the argument that the millionaires may move out of the state, I'm not a millionaire, and I have many middle-class or lower-class friends, and they're planning on moving out of the state because of property taxes. It seems to me that millionaires tax, they could work a way to have millionaires contribute more to the state and not be afraid of them moving out. If they're going to move out, it's not about taxes. It's about other issues, going south, being where their companies are. It's not about taxes. I think that's a bugaboo. So anyway, that's my point.
Joe, thank you very much. That's an interesting point, Matt, especially when he says it's his middle-class friends who are moving out of the state because the property taxes are so high, never mind millionaires who would move out because they get an income tax hike. I mean, I think the assumption that we generally start with is it's the millionaires who have the ability to move out of the state, and the middle-class people are kind of stuck. He's saying he's got friends who are going anyway.
Well, there's definitely, and has been for decades, middle-class people leaving for various reasons, property taxes among them. One of the things that kind of gets lost in this, I mean, a millionaire's tax, we're talking about, I think, between $400 and $500 million in revenue if the governor's millionaire's tax. You know, that's pretty much a drop in the bucket. It's not going to make a huge difference mm-hmm. in anyone's property tax bill. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of factors that go into why New Jersey is an expensive state. It's not only property taxes. And one of the reasons our property taxes are so high is because we fund education and, you know, local services through these. A lot of other states have various other taxes. Towns are allowed to establish local taxes. In New Jersey, for the most part, with a few exceptions, they're not. And there's all kinds of reasons why our property taxes are so high. But the main reason is that we're funding, you know, we depend on so much on that one source of revenue. We don't really spread it around. So it's more noticeable in New Jersey, but also it's a high cost of living state. And that's not all to do with taxes. People often talk about that the cost of living is driving people out of New Jersey. Well, it's next to New York City. not a cheap place, you know, and while Philadelphia compared to New York City is certainly not expensive, it's another major metropolitan area that bookends the other part of the state. It's an expensive place to live because of where it's situated. And it's also got a very highly educated workforce and expensive industries, and that drives up prices too. So, you know, property tax isn't the only thing in terms of expenses that drive people out of state.
And Luz in Newark, I think, is going to further the same part of the conversation. Hi, Luz, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you for having me. Actually, I'm originally a Florida resident, and I moved up to New Jersey. And yes, the schools are phenomenal, and I don't see why the schools have to suffer or downgrade, but just because they're laying off taxing the millionaires, I don't see how middle class is being taxed after our first million. We're also being taxed. We have the same taxes, but they're not having the same consideration for the middle class.
Do you, of course, I have no idea what your life circumstances are, but you moved from Florida, which is probably the most famous state that people allegedly move to avoid a state income tax. Donald Trump for one. And so, I don't know, how does it strike you?
Well, I'm surprised in Florida what's going on. You know, education is going down the drain, for sure. I had a son that was intelligent in math, but it took 2 years to get him tested for gifted, just because there was one social worker for three schools. And each school had an average of 1,000 students. I came here to the school system in New Jersey, and it's phenomenal. But again, why does it have to lay on the burden of the backs of the middle class? Like I said, they're not getting taxed after their first million.
Mm-hmm. Luz, thank you so much. Please call us again. On the other side of this argument, Eddie in Ocean County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Brian. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Sure.
Brian, I'd like to throw out there that an opposite argument, that millionaires should pay less taxes. It seems to me that the millionaires are the ones who are investing and creating jobs. And New Jersey finances are not improving. The state deficit continues to increase as taxes increase. And I think, like your guest said, I think people are more prone to move out in time as the taxes go up. I just wanted to throw that thought in there.
Eddie, if you are concerned about the state, state government deficit, why would you have the people with the most ability to pay taxes pay less?
Because I think if the millionaires invest more, create more jobs, if that will create a greater base of taxpayers.
Eddie, thank you very much. Matt, it's pure trickle down. I don't know if anybody believes that anymore.
Yeah, and I got a dispute about, you know, the state finances not improving, and what you consider a deficit versus what technically is a deficit. The economy's good. Naturally, revenue collections have been better than previous years over the last couple years. You could attribute that to anything. I also want to clarify something with the previous caller said. I mean, millionaires are paying taxes on money over $1 million. The question is whether or not their income over $1 million, every dollar over $1 million earned, whether the tax rate on that income increases. That's what we're debating here.
Right. In fact, related to all of this, here's something I thought was interesting from the speech. Despite the governor's focus on income inequality and wealth inequality, the governor heralded something that President Trump also likes to take credit for, rising wages and record low unemployment happening now.
They only happen when we work together and when we put the people we serve ahead of everything else. We didn't achieve this, by the way, despite our progressive economic policies. We achieved this because of those policies.
Huh. Now, this reminds me of the 90s in New York City, Matt, when the economy was booming and both Democratic President Clinton and Republican Mayor Giuliani took credit, one citing liberal policies, one citing conservative policies. Now we have Trump and Murphy. Is there anything you can cite as progressive state policy under Phil Murphy that, as he claims, has helped these last 2 years as opposed to just national trends?
You know, there's nothing off the top of my head in terms of when it comes to the unemployment rate or the number of jobs added in New Jersey. it always follows national trends. Sometimes it lags behind the nation. I can say that New Jersey's GDP growth has certainly been some of the lower in the nation. It's been pretty close to the bottom, I think, but it's still grown. The state has added jobs. The state was adding, you know, under Obama, Christie would claim credit for jobs added. Now under Trump, Murphy's doing the same. I think the economy is a complicated thing. Everyone, you know,
And on wages going up, was there a state minimum wage hike that took effect under Murphy or anything else?
Yes, they did pass a law, and wages just went up this January to $11 an hour for most workers. They're going to eventually go up to $15 an hour, I believe, by 2024. So there is the minimum wage hike. That's pretty new. You know, like I said, these are, you know, the economy is a very complicated thing. It's very easy to claim credit for good numbers when they're happening under your watch. You know, I think you'll also see them under Christie. You know, he came in during the recession. The economy had its ups and downs. He would often trumpet, you know, news releases. If the unemployment rate went down, but we lost a number of jobs that same month, you'd see one number get trumpeted and the other number downplayed. And you're seeing the same thing under Murphy. Whatever the better number is gets trumpeted.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, where we have a few minutes left with Matt Friedman, who writes the New Jersey Playbook for Politico New Jersey every day as we review Governor Murphy's State of the State address from Tuesday with all the impeachment news and everything else that's been dominating. You might have missed it, but we pulled 9 clips from that speech this morning, and we're cutting through some of them and the themes. We have 2 more clips to go. And the governor also touted something that would sound pretty wonky and bureaucratic in most states, but in New Jersey, it's really a thing.
Today, we have more shared service agreements under consideration than ever before, 980 at last count, and still more coming in.
Shared service agreements, a euphemism, I guess, for the dirty word consolidation in a state with 600 municipalities and school districts in a relatively small geographic area. Remind us, Matt, this is one of the reasons for high property taxes. Every few square miles of New Jersey has its own government.
It definitely doesn't help. I mean, home rule is a big tradition in this state. You have the fourth smallest state in area. We're fairly large in population, but we're tiny in area. And within that area, you got all these different overlapping governments. You have 21 counties. You have 565 municipalities. You have, I don't have a number off the top of my head, how many independent authorities, commissions, all this other stuff. So much government, and certainly that's been cited over the years as one way you can achieve property tax savings. But just by combining functions doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make things cheaper. I think there's one notorious case where Northern Hudson County merged all its fire departments, but for political considerations, you had all kinds of fire chiefs and everything getting the same amount of money, getting same jobs, and it didn't really wind up saving any money. So it really needs to be done in a fashion that actually saves money. But certainly the number of shared service improvements, I believe that is true. They have increased under Murphy. He did put 2 people in charge of encouraging that more. And property taxes have risen at a somewhat slower rate under Murphy than in recent years. I don't think that's attributed directly to that. That's probably more, you know, just a function of a growing economy generally.
And here's a clip of the governor acknowledging something that has not gone so right in the state, something our own New Jersey Public Radio managing editor Nancy Solomon has lifted the veil on big time in her reporting.
We now know that some companies received tax credits they did not deserve and took credit for jobs they did not create. They didn't just hurt their own reputations, by the way. They hurt the reputations of the many more good corporate actors who have done exactly what they said they would do.
So, Matt, can you explain, as you understand it, how New Jersey taxpayers are subsidizing companies for not creating jobs?
Well, the question, essentially, we enacted a vast expansion of New Jersey's corporate tax incentive program in 2013. And the argument is that a lot of companies already situated in New Jersey and paying taxes here falsely claim that they were going to leave the state if they did not get tax incentives. There's a lot of questions about whether they really intended to leave the state. So they got a cut in the taxes they had in their corporate income tax and in the taxes they have to pay. And there's some cases where maybe they were going to leave the state. There's other cases where companies came in and said our location in this into New Jersey from another state is dependent on these taxes. Now, they weren't already paying taxes here, but mm-hmm. there's a difference with the companies that were here and were paying taxes and got a cut in their taxes after threatening to leave. There's a lot of questions about how serious those threats were, and also that politically connected people essentially wrote the laws to get their own companies and their own organizations tax breaks.
Politically connected people like the Southern Jersey Democratic power broker George Norcross, who Nancy has reported on so much, but the governor, I noticed, did not mention by name.
He didn't mention him by name, but he really didn't need to. Everybody knows what he's talking about. And I believe today we're actually, I'm expecting to see a report from a task force the governor formed last year that has really dug up a lot of dirt on George Norcross, who's also, you know, a big political adversary of the governor. And I expect that they're going to put out another report, a big report today. So it will be interesting to see what information, what new information that has.
Let's take one more call. And Joe in Fairview is calling about something that the governor did not mention in the state of the state. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad you're feeling better. I'm a longtime listener and a first-time caller.
Thanks so much.
And thank you for getting through. And yes, I've been displaced since August of 2017 from affordable housing HUD building in Fairview, New Jersey, with my fiance, who's a senior citizen, and we're both disabled. I wrote to the governor recently and asked him if they could provide us with any kind of assistance, and I got a two-sentence memo with a lot of phone numbers on it. And you would think after over 20 months of being displaced that you'd get a little bit more maybe sympathy from the governor's office. But I never hear this governor talking about affordable housing, and it's such a bad problem in New Jersey right now. And with New York sending over some of their homeless to live in apartments that are affordable in this area is not helping the matter either.
Joe, thank you so much. I hope your own situation improves there, and thank you for your good wishes.
Thank you very much. God bless.
So Matt, he's right that while the governor talks about property taxes, which is a New Jersey obsession, he didn't mention gentrification, which is also pushing housing costs up for obviously Joe in Fairview and so many other people.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about gentrification, but in general, affordable housing is a huge issue in New Jersey. Like I said, there's a number of reasons why this is such an expensive state. It is affordable housing in New Jersey is a decades long controversy. There are mandates for towns to have affordable housing, but towns fight those mandates on overdevelopment grounds. It's an incredibly complex issue, you could spend months reading about it.
As we do, spend months talking about gentrification on both sides of the Hudson and elsewhere on this show. So one final thing, Joe raised something that the governor did not touch in his State of the State, and I'll raise one other, unless I missed it, but I don't think I did. Governor Cuomo in the New York State of the State did mention it. It's marijuana legalization. And Cuomo even proposed a unified system for New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania. Were you surprised that Murphy, who is an advocate, didn't go there?
Somewhat surprised, but in terms of marijuana legalization, it's going to be up to voters in November. The ballot question is already passed. It will be there. People will decide. So, frankly, they've given up on the legislative legalization of marijuana. So in terms of laying out his agenda and talking about what they want to do, it's not exactly something that's going to have to be there. So that's part of the reason.
I see. It's going to be on the ballot in November.
It's going to be on the ballot, but then there's the whole issue of how do we implement it, and that's going to be left up to lawmakers and the governor.
Last question. Does your dog bark every time the doorbell rings?
Yes. He does. He does. He's a good watchdog.
That's so. Okay. Good direct answer. Matt Friedman from Politico, who writes the Daily New Jersey Playbook, worth subscribing to if because it's free, for one thing. If you want to follow New Jersey news in a nutshell, New Jersey Playbook on Politico New Jersey and in the email newsletter. Matt, thank you so much for all this time today.
Thank you, and I'd also like to thank my dog, Pancho.
Pancho, good boy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, New Yorker magazine humorist Patricia Marks and New Yorker magazine cartoonist Roz Chast. Together they have a new book of... Who need no introduction, apparently, or invitation from me to applaud for. They have a new book of cartoons with captions, I guess you'd call it, called You Can Only Yell at Me for One Thing at a Time, Rules for Couples. Hi, Patricia. Hi, Roz. Welcome to the Green Space.
Hi.
And as the Green Space audience can see, you did what most authors do when they come for their book interviews. You brought your ukuleles.
We thought it was required.
We will get to the ukulele part later. But what's the deal? Are you in a band?
Well, in our deluded minds, we are.
Yes, or in a parallel universe.
Yes.
And we know that there are infinite parallel universes, so yeah. Yes.
It's called Ucular Meltdown.
Yeah.
Ucular Meltdown. Okay, more to come on that. But listeners on the radio will be showing a few of these cartoons or illustrations on the screens here at the Green Space. And you can see them, too, if you want to, as we stream live video when we're in the Green Space. Go to thegreenspace.org. That's green with an E, the green E at the end, thegreenspace.org, or the WNYC Facebook page. We'll give you a minute to get that stream going before we put up the slides, thegreenspace.org. And we'll take a step back in a minute, but we have the cover of the book up on the screen now, at least I think we do, with the title cartoon. Why did you pick that particular rule for the title, Patricia? You can only yell at me for one thing at a time.
Well, we were struggling with the title, and I was having, let's call it a discussion with my boyfriend, and he said that, and I ran to my typewriter and I said, I have it. And yesterday, my mother asked me what the title of the book is. She's 93. And I told her the title and she said, I know, but what's the title?
And what gave you the idea, Roz, for an illustrated book of rules for couples when other people are writing about things like our last guest, you know, the collapse of Western civilization?
Well, it's sort of in the same field, really. Yeah. Patty asked me to illustrate it, and we've collaborated for years and years, and it was such a great idea. And it was also a sequel to, in a way, or another one in the series of the book that we had collaborated on before this, which was things that Patty's mother has said over the years. And one of them became the title, which was, why don't you write your eulogy for me now so I can correct it?
That was your last book.
Yes, yes.
Another of the rules, and I'll issue a gross out alert for anyone who wants to come back and in 10 seconds. Another of the rules is sexual favors in exchange for cleaning up the cat vomit is a good and fair trade. Is there a story behind that one? Duh. Okay, so let's go to some of these images then, since that one is self-explanatory. Do you want to describe your own illustration here, Roz, and let's see, can we get that next one up?
Yes, remember if you were single, there'd be nobody to watch your luggage at the airport while you go to the restroom.
That's the caption, yes.
Yeah, we were trying to come up with reasons that it was good to be with someone.
I think that's, yeah, sort of the basis of the book, really.
And the guy in that picture, could just get a sign for the luggage that says coated with anthrax, then he wouldn't have to worry about who cleans up after the cat.
Yes.
All right, next slide. Are we looking at Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr here?
This is successful couples resolve their differences in healthy, mature ways like dueling. she is holding up a sword, and she says, "You do too snore," and he is, "Do not." And of course, he's lying in a pool of blood. And
you want to elaborate, Pat?
Well, no one died in the writing of this book.
I was thinking about this. A duel is kind of violent, but it's very straightforward.
And yes. civilized.
Marriage counselors like that these
yes.
days.
Well, we do think that if you do argue about who left the refrigerator door open, the FBI should be called in for an investigation.
Yes. Yes. And I think it's also, a lot of these things are, they're the things that when you read about, you know, resolving differences with couples, you don't really hear about the things that most couples fight about, like loading the dishwasher. And I know I'm right. And my husband and I, it's kind of like a silent fight that goes on and on and on. But basically, he puts the spoons and all the stuff in the wrong way. And I switch them around to the right way, but then the next time I open up the dishwasher, they're all put the wrong way again. So I switch them again, and basically the last person to sort of deal with the dishwasher before you start the cycle gets to kind of put them in the way they want.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we wrote the book is to get it in print that we're the right ones.
You were the ones
correct.
Who were
yes.
right. Yeah, it's
yes.
like I used to say about my kids when they were little. The main thing they argued about was who started it.
Oh, who yeah. started it, yes.
I never understood why the blame game is so frowned upon.
But what if that guy really did snore when he was alive? Do you have a rule for snoring management in a relationship?
I think earplugs yeah. are really the only... I have heard about...
Well, separate continents.
Yes. That's like... And I've heard about something about sewing a tennis ball to the back of somebody's back, but I don't know whether it's, you know, a stranger's back, like a good luck thing. I don't know. I never quite understood that.
Well, like the separate continents does remind me that in New York, you know, we always have these big debates over zoning laws, and you have zoning laws in your
yes.
book, right? We don't have those on the screen, but I see step one, divide the house into zones.
Yes. Well, that has to do with the when a couple is living together and one person is over here and one person is over here, and this is in a house, in a studio apartment, and probably would not be that much of a problem, but it might, if where people are like yelling from room to room. And this is... really,
it's noise pollution.
It's horrible. It's just horrible. Especially if they're like even walking farther away from you while they're talking to you. And then they accuse you of like, you know, my husband will say, you know, Roz, I think you're losing your hearing. And it's like, I am not. I have excellent hearing, you know, but if you're starting to like walk, you know, across the street while you're still talking to me, that's, you know, I'm not going to hear you.
So we've divided this space into zones, but... the problem that my boyfriend and I have is that we argue about what constitutes a zone, because I believe correctly that the bedroom is a one zone and the bathroom next to it is another zone, zone B. But he's consolidated them.
Yeah, and I see you have step one, divide house into zone. Step two, no yelling from one zone to another. Step three, if someone breaks this law, whisper, you're not in my zone. I can't hear you.
Yeah.
And step four, endlessly debate whether the hallway to the bathroom is in the same zone as the bathroom.
Yes, yes.
Great. I think you know how I feel about that.
Listeners, we may have time for one or two of your own rules for couples. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 with Roz Chast and Patricia Marks from The New Yorker, whose new book is called You Can Only Yell at Me for One Thing at a Time, Rules for Couples. Let's see. Let's go on to the next slide. Let's see where I left off here. I got sidetracked by that whole zoning debate. I think I'm seeing something that looks very much like the electricity panel in the basement of my old apartment on Amsterdam. Can you describe this for us?
Yes, this is, if the electricity goes out in the kitchen and neither of you knows where the fuse box is, it's time to move to a new house. And it's like stuff that is in the basement, basically, which is my husband's sort of lair, that I don't know anything about fuse boxes, and that's his department. But yeah, fuse boxes. I don't know whether you have this slide, but one of my favorite slides is the Wordmeister.
No, I don't slide. Have that one. Sorry.
That one is, if one of you is the Wordmeister in the relationship, don't correct every little thing. Save it for when you cannot bear it anymore. And the illustration is a woman with her suitcases packed. She's about to leave. She says, "If I, you know, that was the last irregardless." And part of the reason why I need to bring this up is that I just heard yesterday that the word irregardless has been accepted.
I know.
It's in the, yes, that was my reaction too.
I know. And the reasoning was that it's a regional,
a southern
preference.
Regionalism.
So we're seceding.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, we are. Yet another reason.
Yeah. So it was, if the electricity goes out in the kitchen and neither of us knows where the fuse box is, it's time to move to a new house. I've heard a clothing corollary to that, though it usually applies to single men. Rather than do a laundry, just buy more underwear. Do you know that one?
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Well, we have one more slide left, but I think we should go on to the ukulele portion of the show right now to make sure we get it in.
Okay.
So are you going to play something? Do you want to introduce it and set it up?
Yes.
You want to do that or should I?
You do it.
All right. So I'm looking, struggling to come up with another word besides play. We own ukuleles. And for those of you who are listening, they're this beautiful turquoise. Or teal, or we don't know what color it is, but we love it. And if it were not for this color, we probably wouldn't play the ukulele. It's why we really picked it up. We have the different ukuleles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll just get right to it. You ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay. On your mark, get set, go.
Park, park, park your car kind of near the curb. Ay, 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 you just bumped into Herb.
Okay. We rewrite public domain songs and make them worse.
Yes.
We had a bit of a, well, we broke up for a while in the 90s because we were sued for Hang On Sloopy, which we insisted was in the public domain. And then when that argument didn't work, we insisted that it was a typo and we had meant Hang On Sloppy.
Yes, yes.
Okay, ready?
Okay.
On your mark, get set, go.
Mary had a comfort lamb, comfort lamb, comfort lamb. Mary had a comfort lamb who was a lunatic. And everyone who Mary met, Mary met, Mary met. Everyone who Mary met, the lamb was sure to kick. She took the lamb to Spain one day, Spain one day, Spain one day. She took the lamb to Spain one day. It sat in C12B. It made the pilot curse and cry, curse and cry, curse and cry. It made the pilot curse and cry, and then it went wee-wee. The lamb now has a comfort pig, comfort pig, comfort pig. The lamb now has a comfort pig plus PTSD.
You should stop us because we could go on and on and on.
I can't. Do you have one more? One more?
Sure. Give us a
short one?
Yeah. Give us a
This is short.
Yes.
Yeah. This is how we like to end our performances as they were.
And we have since the 50s, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, slow and whiny.
Yes, slow. We specialize in that, too.
Okay. And off key. On your mark, get set, go.
Oh, give us a drink, not a drink from the sink, but a drink from a Western saloon, or maybe some wine of any old kind to delude us. We're crooning on to you.
Wow. So I have a question about these rules for couples. Did you have to invoke any of these rules with each other while you were writing this book?
No, we're perfect.
Yes,
we've never had a disagreement. We don't live together, so.
Yeah. A lot of fights are just because two people are never meant to share a space that's any smaller than a continent, really. Yeah. And
We've traveled together on book tours, and we have shared the same row in an airplane, and we get along very well with the armrest.
Yes, that's true.
The armrest.
That's just true. Yeah. I think we're also both compulsively early people. So that's, you know, one thing that often happens in couples is that one person likes to play brinksmanship and leave, like, you know, just almost no time to get to the airport, and the other person is just having, like, multiple heart attacks. But we both like to...
We got here last week for this show.
Yes, yes.
You never know about the traffic.
You never know traffic.
And this relates to the final slide that we'll put up from the book. I think many people have been in couples where one partner is chronically late, and Patricia, I see you have a rule for that.
Is it the right one? No.
Oh. Can we go to the next one? Did I get this wrong? Oh, no, I guess not. Okay. The picture that I was thinking of, the late person is saying, but it's only 2 o'clock in Missouri. We will leave it there. I see that you have an event tonight at the Strand Bookstore.
That was last night.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, doesn't matter.
Well, promo it so they'll feel really bad.
Then I'm the chronically late person in this equation. In that case.
We'll be in Darien tonight.
Where? In Darien?
Darien, Connecticut. Yeah.
Okay, we have listeners in Darien.
Yeah.
So do you know the name of the venue?
The Darien venue.
So Darien listeners, go see Patricia Marks and Roz Chess tonight at the Darien venue, talking about and playing the ukulele with excerpts from their new book, You Can Only Yell at Me for One Thing at a Time, Rules for Couples. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from WNYC's City Hall and Politics reporter filling in for Brian today. My next guest is former veteran Republican political strategist and campaign consultant Rick Wilson. For those on Twitter, it's the Rick Wilson. Over the past 30 years, he's become an award-winning ad maker for conservative organizations, causes, and candidates like former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Before Mr. Wilson served in George H.W. Bush's administration. Today, however, the Daily Beast writer and frequent television pundit, Rick Wilson is taking that wealth of experience to offer a masterclass on how Democrats stop President Trump's re-election in 2020. It's the subject of his latest book, Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves, which is a follow-up to his hugely successful Everything Trump Touches Dies. Rick, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's easy to imagine a sect of Democrats sort of rolling their eyes at the idea of taking advice from a long-term Republican operative whose career has been dedicated to helping other Republicans. Mm-hmm. So why should Democrats trust you to deliver sound advice on beating President Trump?
Because until Donald Trump came along, there was a 30-year arc where the Republican Party slowly dismantled the Democrats at state levels all across this country, where we turned blue states red, or we turned purple states red, where we expanded the number of state legislative seats, the number of statewide elected seats, the number of elected judges in the states. We took back and lost the Congress a number of times. We managed to build a system that was enormously successful. And I was, you know, not the only guy, but certainly one of those architects of that system that was enormously successful at electing Republicans by using a lot of things in a toolbox that we're going to see this year. And I tell people this all the time because you learn something in campaigns. What you want is never what exists. What exists is always there in front of you, and you must run the campaign you have to run. You run in the places and the ways you must run if you're going to win. And there's a lot of wish casting among Democrats that I've observed over the years, and we've beaten them because they often do that, where they often say, well, we believe everybody's going to love talking about policy. Well, the dirty little secret is that we learned years ago, no one gives a damn about policy. No one ever. And callers will call and go, I care about policy. People care about policy individually, but in the aggregate and in terms of motivating voting behavior, they don't. So, you know, there are a lot of tricks in this book. There are a lot of traps in this book. There are a lot of descriptions of the ways that the people around Trump, and I don't mean this like clack of grifters and skells and scumbags that are in the White House itself. There are a lot of very smart, very, very very accomplished operatives and strategists who are out there who they're ride or die with this guy. They have to be there. They have no other financial survival mechanism unless they are with Trump. They're going to do everything they can to win, and they are dirty, bloody, backstabbing scumbags. I know this because a lot of them used to work for me coming up in their careers. There are some very tough people out there, and there's a tough job.
And those were the same people that crafted the strategy that you just highlighted that was so successful in taking over all of those legislative seats
right.
across the country, which you are now giving people the guidebook to do, giving the Democrats to do. Your book begins with a prediction for the night of November 3rd, 2020. What's the short version of how you see the night's timeline?
The short version is if the Democrats do what they have traditionally done, and follow their hearts and don't run a metrics-based brutal campaign that's a referendum on the incumbent, they're going to wake up that day and think, oh, it's in the bag, we're good to go. Look, Hillary Clinton's people thought they won that campaign. They were picking out curtains on election day. And that night when the map started to roll up, their shock was palpable. And I predict in this, they go with their instincts and their gut, and the forward for the book is basically a scenario where the election night leads to the shock and awe of a Trump re-election. Now, the same chapter plays out at the end of the book.
Only having listened to your advice,
having listened to the evil guy's advice, and run a different kind of campaign. And you know, one thing I think it's important in the book, I am not trying to tell Democrats what their ideological position should be. I'm not trying to tell them what their policy position should be. I'm not trying to tell them that you have to listen to me because I'm right about X or Y ideological issue on whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy or social policy, whatever. Not in the slightest. I'm showing them that there is a mechanism to campaigns, and that mechanism is something that unless they produce a generational superstar like a Barack Obama or a Bill Clinton or a John F. Kennedy, my team is a really big advantage if they don't have a generational superstar. And let's be perfectly honest, there are no Barack Obamas in this field. No matter who you like, there are no Barack Obamas in this field. There are no people that are so gifted on every single political front that they're going to dominate it.
So you're talking process and strategy. And one of your recommendations is that you suggest the Democratic nominee focus on 15 states.
Right.
Why 15? You know, it seemed like it was a much smaller number in 2016,
right,
where the contest was decided. What makes up this larger swath?
There is some play. Well, first off, I know there are a lot of people on the progressive side who hate the Electoral College with a fire of a million suns. I understand that, okay? But it is what it is. It is going to be the system this year. No matter how much time you waste talking about it, no matter how many times you screech about it, the Electoral College will in fact be how this election is decided. Maybe not in the future, but this time, that's where it's at. You have to win it. It doesn't matter how well you do in California, but this election is over in 35 states. I know people hate hearing that, but it's over. I know how Mississippi is going to vote. I know how Oregon is going to vote. What I don't know is how North Carolina and Arizona and Florida and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota and Ohio are going to vote.
So all purple states.
Purple, some are leaning a little more red, some are leaning a little more blue. But those are the states that are in flux right now. And those are the states where this game of numbers that was played in 2016, where Trump won the election by fewer than 100,000 votes in a few key states, those states have to get all of the resources. They have to get all the manpower. They have to get every single boot on the ground that the Democrats can deploy. And if the Democratic candidate is going to California for any reason other than to get sacks of cash, it's political malpractice. There's one thing in campaigns you never get back, and that's a day. You can raise more money, you can run more ads, you can hire more people. You'll never get a day back. And so the calendar is going to run out very quickly, and they need to focus on those states. And if they don't, that Donald Trump most certainly will.
Listeners, we want you to join this conversation. My guest is former Republican political strategist Rick Wilson. Put on your campaign operative hats and tell us how you think the 2020 November election will play out or should play out. What strategy should the Democratic presidential nominee follow? What will lead to victory in 2020? And we'll let Rick Wilson react to your recommendations. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Rick, there seems to be this tension among the Democratic candidates between appealing to those swing state voters that you were talking about, that they need to beat Trump, and then appealing to the energy within the Democratic base. How much do you think focusing on one group hurts your vote count with the other?
The Democrats have a beautiful asset here. They need to understand it. Donald Trump is everything they need to motivate their base. The Democratic base proved in 2018, and we've seen it in focus groups and polling ever since then, they will crawl over broken glass. They will fight off rabid wild animals. They will burn down the village. They will do anything they can to get out there and vote against Trump. They're going to be fine. But the swing vote in this election that they need to keep an eye on, particularly in those swing states, are suburban women, who 53% of them voted for Donald Trump last time. Now, they broke in 2018, but they are not people who, and some tough love here, these women voters, right, these educated voters in the suburbs, they're not like waking up in the morning and thinking, hey, I can't wait to put the aristocrats in tumbrils and take them to the guillotine. You know, they're not socialist. They're not far left progressives. They really, really want to return to something normal. They're not driven by a progressive passion. Now, maybe you get them and educate them someday and change them to that position someday. But right now, as I point out in the book, and I'm a pretty blunt guy, don't scare the S out of them, okay? Don't scare them. They're skittish. Barack Obama stole them from the Republicans, and we were like, how do we get that situation to rectify? And, you know, it's difficult, but Barack Obama didn't frighten Republicans. He didn't scare them. And Trump, to a great degree, scares these voters. So if he's the one scaring them, bring them in with open arms. And look, the progressive base, I've never seen them more motivated. And if any group or any candidate says, oh, well, I'm going to take my ball and go home, and I'm not going to come out and vote unless I get exactly who I want with exactly the policies I want versus Donald freaking Trump, they're not really on your team.
So it's so interesting because everything that you're saying there kind of defies that conventional wisdom that you need to give voters something to vote for and not vote against. And what I think you're saying is all these voters need is to hear, I'm running against Donald Trump, and that is what will drive them to the polls.
Every re-election campaign, whether it's a state house race or a congressman or a senator or a governor or a president, every re-election is a referendum on the incumbent every time. There is no defying it. It is absolutely like iron historical fact. Do you want 4 more years or 2 more years of this guy? The question is very simply put, do you want 4 more years of this? Is it good for your kids to see 4 more years of this? Is it good for this country to see 4 more years of this? And the reason that I've written this is I think 4 more years is an existential threat to the country on a whole host of areas. And again, the motivation for Democratic voters is there every day on Twitter. And there every day with, you know, his ridiculous wig and his ridiculous words and his dangerous behaviors. And that should be sufficient, I would hope.
I want to bring some callers into this conversation. Melanie in Kent, Ohio. Thanks so much for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show, and thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I called in the minute Rick Wilson got on the line because I think this is a spot-on segment. I lived for a long time in New York City. I'm a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, but I've called in a lot of times to this show because I was born and raised in Ohio, Rust Belt. I've lived more than half my life. I still have family in Arizona. I've got Trump supporters over here. I've got Democrats over there. But what I'm hearing now among everybody, especially the Trump voters and the swing voters, is that they're not swayed. They're still supporting him, and that's because the Democrats haven't made a case about how the Trump policies have affected them. People don't realize how these tax cuts, the $30 trillion that we're going to face, and or I don't know what the number is, but the unthinkable amount of money that we're going into debt each year because the very richest are like avoiding taxes legally, and people at the bottom are being affected. They don't see that clear line. People don't understand. They support the assassination of Soleimani. People who voted for Trump, they see this border, and they're ignoring the fact of what's happening to children. I think it really needs to come home to like how this is affecting children. It needs to come home to them personally, on a personal level, and it's not doing that. The Democrats aren't doing that. I think I don't know, I'm not even covering the base on this, but what I'm seeing is that the needle is not turning, and because of the gerrymandering of the states, it's locked in. The way the Electoral College works, you know, if you get 60 over here and 40 over there, 100% goes to the 60 in
Melanie,
the vote, you know, so...
Melanie, thank you so much for your call. I want to jump in and give Rick a chance to respond to everything you said there.
Thank you, Melanie. And I think your point is very on. You're very on point there. They're not yet making the case to voters in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, that Donald Trump's economic promises have been fantastic for Wall Street and have been fantastic for hedge fund guys. And, you know, people think this is ironic for me. Oh, you're a conservative. Why would you not like that? Because I think crony capitalism has been one of the things that's broken this country's politics very profoundly. And, you know, I knew the lobbyist, one of the lobbyists who wrote the tax bill. And I jokingly asked him, I said, is there anything in middle class in here? What's the thing? He's like, what do I care? He was, you know, he was going to get a percentage of what he got for his hedge fund clients, and the guy is very, very wealthy now. So that idea that Trump is doing things that he claims are these economic miracles, I mean, look, you need to call BS if you're the Democrats. You need to say, where are those steel mills? You promised hundreds of new steel mills in Ohio, Donald. You promised a trade war that would make us rich, and instead it's causing record farm foreclosures in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota. Where's that, Donald? I mean, getting into his face, again, it all comes down to making it a referendum on Donald Trump. No one's ever going to read your 695-page health care plan. Even worse, no one's ever going to read your 695-page plan for mitigating the Great Lakes grass carp. But these campaigns produce mountains and mountains and mountains of policy papers. All those things are good for is for guys like me to read through them and find things to turn into demagogic ads.
Well, on that note, there's much more to talk about in this. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Republican political strategist and so-called Never Trumper, Rick Wilson. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, WNYC's City Hall and politics reporter, filling in for Brian today. And we're back with former Republican political strategist Rick Wilson about how Democrats can win the 2020 election. And Rick, just before that break, you were listing off some policy proposals. It sounded to me like you were talking about a candidate who has a plan for that, which is a policy for everything. And my question is, you know, you wrote in your book that, quote, Democrats must understand that corruption is always a killer app in politics,
yes,
parting even hard partisans from candidates. So how does that square with the idea that more authentic, the more authentic delivers of the corruption message, you know, Bernie and Warren, are they not candidates you believe could win?
Look, I'm going to probably really make a lot of your audience angry. I think Bernie is Trump re-election insurance. I think if Bernie Sanders is the nominee.
And why is that?
Part of it comes from basic gut instinct. Republicans love to have a candidate who is who lives up to all of the tropes and the, you know, the angry left-wing crazy-eyed socialist game. And yeah, you know what? They'll say X is a socialist no matter what is a sort of a way to excuse that. But this country really has a big cultural divide. And Bernie doesn't scan with a lot of people in this country who could be gotten by a Warren or a Biden or a Klobuchar or a Buttigieg in a way. And Bernie would just, he comes across as, you know, he is the crazy old socialist poetry professor at Bennington Community College. And he's so easy to turn into a caricature. And they will, and I guarantee you, I put my hat on for a second. I think, what would I love if I was still on that team? I would love Bernie. He'd be my number one pick.
But how does that then connect to what we were talking about before? Mm-hmm. You know, the suburban women who really just want to come out to vote for someone that's not Trump. So
I think Bernie is a great promiser of free stuff. But I also think that there's a degree of perceived anger about Bernie. He's also, he's Trump's same age, but he scans as older. And the guy literally just had a heart attack. And there are a lot of factors in that I think are going to play. And look, I think Warren has grown as a candidate tremendously. I think she's run a very smart effort. But some people have the sort of magical political felicity of connecting. Mm-hmm. And some people don't. And you can't just paper those things over. I mean, look, Joe Biden does not know policy for his life, okay? But you sit Joe Biden in a room, everybody wants to have a beer with Joe Biden. He's got a certain degree of like avuncular charm to him. And again, I'm not trying to pick the Democratic nominee. But I do believe that Bernie would absolutely, I think Trump will win 44 or 45 states if it's Bernie.
So I want to bring a caller into this conversation. Fabio in Hicksville, Long Island. Welcome to WNYC. You're on with Rick Wilson. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for having me. So before I get to my question, I just want to say the concept of campaigning on saying I'm not Trump is nonsense. Hillary Clinton campaigned on that in 2016 and she lost. Like, Trump was in Pennsylvania talking to these coal miners who were in prospect of losing their jobs. And we need to talk about what options we can bring to them. And somehow it's become left-wing and radical to want the lower class to have things like a higher national minimum wage or health care. And so nominating a milquetoast candidate who, like, sits on the fence is not what wins. It's exactly what Rick Wilson as a Republican wants. He said he wanted Trump in 2016 and that he wasn't going to win as a candidate. And, of course, he won. So why should we be listening to this guy? He's saying a beer with Biden is appealing. That's what people said about Bush, like, why we want to nominate these horrible candidates. And to Rick Wilson, I would say crony capitalism is not a glitch. It's not part of capitalism.
Tommy, just first off on the crony capitalism question, I've written a lot about that over the years, and I am dramatically, steeply opposed to crony capitalism in all forms. I departed years ago from a lot of my Republican friends on that. I strongly believe government should not put its thumb on the scale and pick winners and losers, whether you're a Republican president or a Democratic president. Now, secondly, the fact is that there were two players in the 2016 election. And while Donald Trump was was flawed in every way and could not win on paper. It's exactly the predicate of my book. Donald Trump couldn't win, but the Democrats could lose. And Hillary Clinton managed to lose. How did she manage to lose? She stopped going to Wisconsin. She stopped going to Pennsylvania. She stopped going to Ohio. She went to California. She went to Florida a few times. She did not do the work of the campaign. This book is about doing the work of the campaign. And the fact is, there were all of us fighting against Donald Trump in 16, you know, in the Republican Party, where it was a shrinking number. And the fact of the matter is, you learn the lessons of defeat in politics more than you learn lessons from victory.
Fabio, I just wanted to see if you could tell us, do you have a candidate that you're currently supporting?
I'm sure you can guess it from my speech, but it would be Bernie Sanders, yes.
Okay. And so, you know, what is it? It sounds like you're potentially a younger voter. Is that fair?
I would say that's correct. I'm currently in college.
Okay. You know, what is it that for you is motivating, you know, Bernie Sanders? And you know, how do you see this election as different than in 2016?
Well, I would say what motivates me towards Bernie Sanders is the fact that you have all these candidates on the field. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren, to a lesser extent, I know she's backtracking on it, but not that many voters, I mean, candidates who are actually appealing to the lower class in terms of health care and national minimum wages and things that appeal to them. Most of the time, it's what this guy Rick Wilson is saying like, oh, Trump is a demagogue and he's evil and we need to stop him. That's not a real answer to anything. And if you just repeat that same shtick from 2016, it's not going to work. So what I would say for this election is that I feel like more voters are cognizant of that. And that's exactly why Bernie Sanders has been rising in the polls.
All right. Fabio, thank you so much for calling WNYC. And Rick, I want to give you a chance to
sure.
respond to Fabio's response. But I think part of also what he, as a caller, sort of represents for us is this energized younger swath of voters.
Right.
And so how does your calculus for how to win an election take those voters into account?
We did see an uptick in younger voters in 2018. We did see an uptick. But the hard reality is this. You know who votes in elections? Old people. You know who votes every time in elections? Really old people. Old people vote. This is a iron law of politics. Everybody knows it, especially as a guy who grew up in Florida politics. Old people vote. Young people, you know the peak of young voter turnout in this country in the last 40 years? Was those two young, sexy guys, George H.W. Bush and Mike Dukakis. That was the peak year of young voter turnout. And young voter turnout is a dragon the Democrats chase all the time. Once in a while, they'll goose it a little bit with an Obama-type candidate, but it is not going to decide the election. The people that are going to decide this election are in swing states. They are over 50 years old. That's just a hard fact of campaigning. And look, I wish everybody had a higher degree of participation, but that's where we end up.
I want to take another caller. Let's go to Elena in Florida. Elena,
yes.
Welcome.
Yes,
and Elena, what city are you in Florida?
I'm in Dunedin. It's west of Tampa. We
sure.
are in the only one of two counties on the West Coast that went twice for Obama, but we went for Trump. So I couldn't agree more that it's an honorable and crucial thing to get people to realize voting against someone is essential. I've been voting against people since McGovern was the last person I voted for in 72. So, but that's crucial. Otherwise, you let demagogues and Hitler get in if you don't oppose what's wrong. So bravo for saying that. The question I have and what I'm concerned about is my millennial friend saying that if Biden's the candidate, everyone she knows, she's 30, everyone she knows is going to stay home. I think Amy Klobuchar is, I'm left of left, but I would vote for a tree stump against Trump. But I think Amy Klobuchar is one of the only ones who has the wherewithal to take the middle states, the Midwest, the suburban women, all of these groups, including the young people. So what's going on? Why can't we get this going for you? What do you think about that?
I think that Amy, and I actually like Amy Klobuchar. I met her down at Texas at the Tribune Festival last year. And I think that there is a lot to like about her in terms of that upper Midwest, both ag and industrial belt that swung to Trump in the last election. I think that she's had trouble getting clear of, first off, an incredibly crowded field with a lot of folks that were that honestly had no business being there. And she managed to hustle and keep herself in the game. But now the field is crowded because, you know, you've got Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg sucking every bit of oxygen out of the room. You've got a battle of the progressives between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, which is, you know, media bait, and folks love covering that. And so she's had a difficult path to get more attention and more engagement. You know, there's a joke about, you know, people either run for president or they run for vice president. She would be a top tier pick for anybody to think about as a VP candidate. And I think she's got a future in this. And look, she may be one of those people that this is the practice run and she gives it another go, because the majority of Democrats in the country are not progressives. And the Republicans like to caricature all Democrats as being left of Marx. But, you know, the Hidden Tribes Project from Pew and work from Pew, they've gone out and frankly, Republicans have gone out and studied it. A lot of Democrats are not so far to the left. They're behavioral Democrats. They're not ideological Democrats. And so I think Amy is in that sweet spot where she could do well in the future. And again, she just doesn't have the name ID to push through this very crowded field. And by the way, I'm from Tampa originally. Dunedin's a beautiful place, home of the Dunedin Scotsman.
Rick, right as you were coming in, our newscaster Richard Haidt was talking about how New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has just announced that he is dropping out of the race. You know, can you give a little immediate postmortem on what you think happened there and why race didn't take off?
He ran out of money, first off, and that, you know, no bucks, no Buck Rogers, as they say. And Cory had a proposition that he was going to be the Obama of 2020. He was going to be high-flown in his rhetoric and aspirational in his rhetoric, and that was going to do what? That's, you know, it's the underpants gnome theory. You know, first, you know, he's going to be inspirational. Then he's going to be president. But that big step in the middle was the one where he didn't quite connect. And look, he did okay. He had a few good moments in a few of the debates, a few sort of standout moments. But that's not sufficient anymore to show that, you know. And the thing is, you've got to be the candidate who can show the Democratic voters you're going to beat Trump.
You are an expert in targeted ads, and we were just talking a moment about Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer. Mm-hmm. How do you think they are shaping this race just by, you know, the sheer volume of money they're dumping and spending on these ads that are all across the country?
Well, as I like to jokingly say, you could have had the U.S. Senate for that money. Okay. Mitch McConnell for the U.S. Senate this year will be able to raise about $200 million for the Republicans that need help. Think about what $200 million of Mike Bloomberg's money would have done in the Senate. And then you end this problem swiftly. But vanity is a powerful force in politics. People get in the race and stay in the race often because their vanity is very powerful. Both Steyer and Bloomberg are at the rate they're spending, they'll crack $500 million before the nomination. And because I suspect they'll both grind until they can possibly, and until they can't possibly grind anymore. That money that's being spent, if I were king, I'd spend it elsewhere for better political outcomes in this cycle. If I were king, I would be having Mike Bloomberg spend, you know, $100 million doing voter registration and data analysis of that voter registration. But vanity is a powerful thing.
Let's take one more caller. Angelo in Stanford, Connecticut. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me. Hey, Rick, you're great on Bill Maher.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I was discussing a bizarre or not so bizarre idea with my beautiful wife. Would it hurt or help the Democrats if the final candidate came forward with their proposed cabinet ready for the ticket? Example, Biden chooses Warren as VP, but he also says, and I'm going to bring on Mayor Pete for Veterans Affairs, Cory Booker, HUD, Beto runs the ATF, for example, Inslee for EPA, and so on and so forth.
I think there's a benefit to teasing some of those names, where you say, I want a person like a Amy Klobuchar for Commerce Department, or I want a person, you know, like Cory Booker for HUD. I always hesitate to try to lock in on things like that, because then they become, then that candidate's all their downsides become, you know, an attractive nuisance for the Trumpers to go after. But it's an interesting idea of showing you're going to have, and particularly if the candidate is considered a little bit weaker as a leader, to show that you're going to have a team of strong people around you.
Angelo, thanks so much for calling WNYC. Rick, one final question. You know, for whatever strategy the Democrats follow, the wild card in certainly the 2016 election was Russian interference.
Sure.
On TV yesterday, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien downplayed that threat in the upcoming election, but said there are lots of countries that want to affect our elections and want Trump to lose. How much do you agree that Russia won't be an outsized factor in this upcoming election?
Is he not on Facebook or Twitter at any moment? They are playing the same game. They're playing with the same intensity level. Everyone else in the intelligence community is ringing the alarm bells and turning on the sirens, because these guys they got away with it. And when you let the Russians get away with shenanigans, there will be more shenanigans. And there have been no sanction of any meaningful level against them. There's been nothing that's changed the relationship on how Donald Trump basically calls Vladimir Putin, asked to wax his car every weekend. So there's no punishment for Russia the last time, so they're going to do it again. And you know, O'Brien is one of these guys in the White House who knows to play the game, and to say that, you know, to excuse Russia for everything is their go-to position.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. I'm Bridget Bergen, City Hall and politics reporter from the WNYC newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehr. My guest has been Rick Wilson, former Republican political strategist and author of the new book, Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Bridget. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.